Welcome back to Sheep Stuff You Should Know. This is Dr. Rosie Bush, and I'm joined here today by the world famous Dan Makin.
Yay. What world is that?
You're famous, Dan. Accept it.
Oh, man. How are you?
Nice to I'm see good. Hear you. I know. It's been a long time.
It's been a while. I don't think I've recorded since ASI, have I?
No.
No. Wow. That was in January.
Yep.
Ancient history.
And I saw you briefly in February for our Hoplin Lambing School.
That's right. That's right.
You came
and helped at our cold and not quite wet.
Not as wet as the husbandry workshop.
No. The husbandry workshop, for those of you who aren't in California, we actually had sheep lining up two by two all on their own looking for the
storm. It flooded.
Oh, my word. I am so amazed that people stuck with us that day.
Yeah, that was incredible. This last workshop, people actually canceled.
But the two young women who showed up were really enthusiastic and engaged and jumped right into the work. And it was really cool. It's really fun.
Yeah. And I think they'll get right. Like they have goats and they'll be kidding this year soon. So they'll get to practice the things they learned very soon, which will be very cool.
Yeah. 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 Which is huge.
Yeah.
So what's been going on in the world of the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine? But you're getting ready to head out of town, right?
I am. It's been crazy. It's always crazy in my world. It's so good. We had all kinds of workshops going on and people want more, which is great. I've been working a lot with Dr. Fauna Smith, who's our new livestock herd health and repro faculty, who's, you know, her main area of focus is sheep and goats. And so she and I are the only people at the university that's in our job description to work with sheep and goats.
There's sheep and goats right there in the job description.
Yep. Nice. Yep. It's printed. So she's been really fun to work with. I've brought her out to a couple of farms and introduced her to some producers. And she actually came with me to Hoplin for the mastitis study I'm doing. And
Cool.
So she's been there before. I don't think she said she hadn't been there as a student or a resident, but she grew up 40 minutes from there. So she had been there as a kid at a school trip.
Yeah.
So she was like, it was really neat to go back. And I think Hoplin's excited that researchers are engaging with them again. And
Definitely.
So that was fun.
And you hauled some equipment up there to be able to milk.
So UC, the vet school, gosh, I don't know when their first version of this chute was designed, but it must have been designed in the 70s or the 80s. And it's this big steel trailer that has a chute. And then it has these ladders, like ramps, that have full solid sides on either side that get the sheep up into the chute and then down. And those kind of all peel away and kind of pack into itself. So it's this nice little compact trailer when you're driving, and it has a head gate that swings open and then a tailgate that you slide all manually. So I did that job yesterday because I didn't want to ask Fauna to do that. And I was, so usually the person up there on top of the trailer is manning the gates. And then I was scanning their EIDs. Otherwise people are marked, like usually it's used for preg scanning. So there's a big open window in the back quarter. It's so their right hind side is open. Mm-hmm. And usually that's where we teach students to scan from that side. Mm-hmm. So it's different from like how Dr. Bravo scans at Ryan's place, because he sits on their left side and scans up between their right leg and their udder. to get to that right flank. So he's kind of, reaching up and pulling back. And with this, we're pushing up into their flank. So it's a little bit different. So when we teach students that way, it's like, okay, this is one way. But it's a really neat shoot. And I've brought it to a couple places and folks like it. So this is the second version. It was rebuilt like 15 years ago because the first version was kind of falling apart a bit rusted. This one's rusty again. But yeah.
That's cool. That's cool. Did you get any pictures of it?
Yeah, I have some. I'll have to post it again. I have some. Cool. But it's neat. And it's perfect for taking milk samples because they're up. So you don't have to bend over.
Yeah.
The whole hind end is open. You can get to, they are still stompy. It doesn't squeeze them. So
they still like to jump around. Yeah.
At one place we were at, they had a combi clamp, and that was actually really nice because they're squeezed. If you catch them far enough back, they're in the perfect position to be able to milk them basically from behind. That worked really nicely.
Was that Nathan Medler's?
Yeah.
Yeah. I've not gotten to work with his setup. I want to go out and help him one of these days.
Yeah, I'm debating. I'm considering whether I should invest in a shoot for my program to help with research projects, and especially because a lot of these are on farms and
that kind of equipment.
Yeah, and the neat thing about the combi clamp is that it doesn't require any power source.
Right.
Unless you're using the scale, then I think. But I think even that's battery operated. So it has a scale. It's totally human powered, and it's just a foot pedal. But it's so counterintuitive to me because to catch the animals, you have to step backwards. And I would want to lunge forward.
I want to see it work because that would be interesting.
Yeah.
So they move forward if you're stepping back? Does that encourage animal movement if you're stepping back?
Maybe. Yeah. So it's like it's a lever. So it when you step on the pedal, it pulls the panel that's farthest from you towards them.
Okay.
And then that panel is soft-sided. So nothing's like, it works, they use it on goats and sheep. And they did have to put kind of a rubber mat on that soft-sided panel because otherwise they just kind of like squeeze their way through.
Especially goats.
Mm-hmm. But goats are a little bit more angular. So that soft side really kind of helps catch them without any injuries or anything. It was really neat.
That's cool.
I really like it. But I'm also thinking about if I'm by myself, if I want something that's like pneumatic and has those.
Right.
I'm sure there's a huge difference in cost.
Yeah. But those are all considerations. I think all that equipment that allows you to make your labor more efficient, whether it's for doing research like you're doing or if labor is more expensive, maybe the equipment needs to be part of the priority, right?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
The older I get, the less I like bending over all day.
Yeah, flipping every sheep. Yep.
So we talked about this before we started, but I haven't been on the podcast now for, 8 weeks almost, I think.
Yeah.
And right after ASI, so late January, we had some pretty dramatic things come up in our family. My wife, Sammy, who's also my vet, was diagnosed with brain cancer. And she's now had a couple of surgeries, and we're starting cancer treatments and lots of doctor appointments and all sorts of. For somebody that likes to plan way, way in advance, lots of reminders to try to take things a day at a time, which has been challenging, and lots of offers of help. And I kind of wanted to explore the idea of offering help, but probably more importantly, from my perspective, accepting help and how hard that can be for us sometimes. And I just, you know, not that looking for sympathy or anything like that, but I think that having people know what you're dealing with is helpful for dealing with something like this too.
Well, I thank you for sharing that with everyone. I think that takes a lot of courage. I can't imagine going through what you guys are going through. And yeah, I think we all, like, you know, like you said, when we found out, it was like, oh my gosh, what can I do? Like, you know, it's such an unimaginable thing. You don't even know where to start. And I was just like, well, the last thing they're going to want to do is cook. And maybe that's all you want to do. I was like, oh, I can make all your meals. And then it's like, oh, you know, talking with you and how your girls came home and your freezer's full. And so it is amazing how communities come together. And the first thing we want to do is feed you.
Food is huge. Food, and as this goes on, you know, having stuff in the freezer has been so reassuring and comforting and helpful. It's also, so this is probably the rancher part of me. It's also really special to get to have food that we raised during something like this too. Makes you appreciate that all the more, I think, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And speaking of the ranchers, you already have such an incredible group of people that you're surrounded by in your area. And when this came up, I mean, like you said, you're a planner, and that's how you are so successful with what you do and all the aspects of your life. Like, what went through your mind where were you at with your sheep, and, you know, what were you thinking with?
You know, it's hard to believe that it was only 2 weeks before Sammy's first surgery that we did our extremely rainy workshop, you know, sheep husbandry workshop. And so we were, theoretically, we thought we were about 5 weeks away from lambing.
You had some surprises there.
we had a ram lamb that ended up being fertile. And so we had, I think, a half dozen ewes give birth well before we expected lambs. But
it's
all
good
this
ram lamb.
Good ram lamb. Yep. Yeah. He knows his job.
Yeah.
And I will say that these lambs that he sired are absolute chunks. They're really looking good.
That's awesome.
But this all hit, and we were like 3 weeks from starting to lamb. And I mean, it's not a huge number of sheep, but it's pasture lambing, and we take it pretty seriously, and we kind of focus all of our year on being ready for that 4 or 5 week stretch of time when the lambs are coming. And so, you know, I had bought out a partner this year who is still around, and Roger stepped in and started checking sheep and moving fence and just really carrying that load, especially in the times that we were at the hospital so much. And my initial thought was, gosh, I just need to sell a bunch of sheep. I think Ryan said, you can always get more sheep, you can't get more time.
Yeah.
And selling late bred ewes in the middle of the wettest winter we've had in a decade was not something that was real
exciting.
Easy to do. Real exciting to very many people. And another friend just stepped up and said, you don't need to make the decision about what to sell or not to sell with everything else going on. Why don't you just send all your sheep to me and we'll lamb them out and you can figure it out once the lambs are weaned. So Ryan Indart, who preceded me at California Wool Growers as president, just said, let me do it. And it took me about a week to figure out that, yes, I need to let him do that. Nathan Medler, who we talked about, just said, I've got a trailer, we can put everything you're shipping in and I'll take them to Fresno. And You know, I had actually had cattle ranchers show up the day we loaded to help us load. So being part of a community like this, when something like this happens, it's just, it's humbling and amazing. And it's just, I think the other realization out of all this for me, talking to another sheep producer here in California who's recently gone through some similar things, said, it's hard to think of it this way when you're going through it, but accepting help is a gift to the people that want to help you.
Yeah.
And that's hard, really hard to remember sometimes.
Yeah.
Hard to remember. And I, you know, I guess one of the questions I have for you is kind of how you feel when somebody like that has something happen. Cause I know what I tend to want to jump in and, like you said, fix food or do something, but how do you respond when you know somebody needs help and maybe they don't even know it yet?
Yeah. Well, and especially when it's something that I can't actually fix the problem.
Yeah.
It's hard. Like, you feel helpless. And I know you guys probably feel a lot of that, but you know, so it's like, I think you just trying to contribute in any way that you can. And I imagine people find a lot of creative ways to do that. Like, yeah. I'm still working on Sammy's sweater, but we talked about making her sweater a year ago, maybe 6 months ago, with the rest of the wool that I have from your flock. And I was like, yeah, I will do that. And then this happened. It's like, this is what's going on my needles right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's just like, I mean, that doesn't change. It doesn't help, but I don't know. I feel like it's something.
But it absolutely does help. I think one of the things for both Sammy and I that has been really helpful, all of us help in ways that we can. So what I can do to help somebody is not the same thing that you can do to help somebody.
Yeah.
And I think looking at all of the help that we've received, I have realized that just in being part of a community like this and stepping up and doing what you can do, I can't do what Rosie can do, but I can do what Dan can do. Mm-hmm. And that has helped people in our community, whether I realized it or not. Mm-hmm. And so that is coming back to us now. And I guess part of it is just being part of this community, not just a geographic community, but this community of farmers and ranchers that has been so humbling for us.
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah. And I, because people even really far from you have, you know, sent things. And I think there's a lot of people who care about you guys. And I don't know. I think we just want to ease the burden, you know?
And that it has and continues to. It definitely continues to. I think the other, you know, not to fall into any kind of self-pity or anything, but one of the other things that something like this does is make you realize what's kind of important to you.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what was important to me was not sending all my sheep to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
To have a reason to go outside and see sheep and see lambs. And that's been really helpful to just kind of have that anchor point and whatever, with everything else so chaotic, to have that little bit of normalcy.
Yeah.
Is part of it too.
Get you guys outside and.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I think with the lambing schools and everything, like, I've been so appreciative and amazed that you've still been so engaged and, like, you know, and meaningfully, like, not just there, but like, you can tell it's what you enjoy doing. You're such a great teacher. And at the lambing school, there was a student there who, you probably remember, she's like, I'm just totally fangirling because I listen to the podcast. And she was just so, like, so happy that you were there, even, you know, on Zoom. And And it's very, even remotely, like it's really neat how you connect with people. And like, yeah, I was just impressed that you're able to still like, I mean, it's not like it's work for you. Like you're there and you give everything you have and you love your like what you do with the sheep and lambing, and it was really cool. It was neat.
That suggests a question to me that I'm interested in your perspective on. Is it different being a food animal veterinarian than it is working on cats and dogs in terms of that sense of community or engagement? Is that,
I
do you think that's different?
absolutely, I do. I think, well, it maybe it depends on where you are,
Sure,
right?
sure.
Because I think that there are clinics that are totally part of a community, small animal clinics, right? I definitely had that where I was in Hollister, where it was a small clinic. We were available to people. We were the only clinic in four counties that offered emergency services, so that kind of, like we got cookies and I don't know, people were really grateful for how available we were. And we also weren't one of the we were not one of the most expensive clinics in the area, so we were more accessible to people. I don't think that, I had a conversation recently about how newer grads, it's hard for them to barter services. It's hard for them to accept payment plans because they do have capital costs and loans and things that older or even like vets who graduated 30 years ago, their loans were drastically different from
That's a
what,
really good point.
so even though they probably want to engage with the community, these different structures make it really challenging. They either have to do a number of patients in an hour to be able to make up, or they have to charge a lot, or both. Right. So I think because of those things, it does make a lot of veterinarians have a really hard time really enjoying their clients and
That's a really
being more
good
of a
point.
part of it. But
The whole
I,
structure has changed, hasn't it?
which I don't know how to fix that, because it's also a challenge on the livestock side. I think it's why we have so few livestock veterinarians, because it is, I mean, you just can't make as much money.
Just by the nature of how many patients you can see in an hour, you can't.
Right. You can see 4 to 5 patients in an hour in a hospital setting. Whereas when you're driving to a farm, that can be an all day, half day event. But the neat thing about that is that you can really be involved and understand their production. I think that we're really invested in our clients' success, like not just the animal, the individual, but that individual is a sentinel for the rest of the herd. It is a marker for future production performance. And so, like, yeah, maybe you're out there on an emergency, but really good herd vets are thinking about what this one presenting case means for that farm. And I think that's what's really cool, is you're not just looking at individuals, you're looking at the big picture, and you're working with a person to and their family a lot of times. Even in Seabarn, when I was in the hospital setting, we had kids come in with their livestock that they were raising, and I mean, every time I had to do a C-section, I was like, I think the hospital's a little different now because of COVID. They don't let people come in anymore. But it was like, I need their help. Try these babies off. Get them breathing.
That's funny you say that. I have been thinking about that with both of our girls being home, and how when both of them were in high school, it was maybe not the coolest thing to think their dad was a sheep herder. But it's okay now that they're a little older, and actually they both jumped in and done stuff during lambing that I just couldn't get to because they know how to do it. They grew up with it. And that as a dad, that's a really gratifying thing too.
That is so cool.
What, not to totally shift gears from this, but I do understand that by the time this episode is posted, you will be in the frigid north of northeastern Idaho. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So one of the conversations we had after the really wet husbandry class, what kinds of gear are you taking to be ready for being in the snow and the cold in Du Bois, Idaho?
I don't know if I'll ever truly be prepared. I have a stack of hand warming packets, so
good. Good. Yep,
got that checked off.
Yeah, that's always good.
No,
wool in your wardrobe, I would imagine, right?
Yeah. So actually, in preparation for this trip, I ordered 5 pairs of wool socks from Imperial Yarn. They're awesome. So thick and so amazing.
Awesome.
So I'm really worried about my feet. That was the main thing. And the only thing, so I was in South Dakota when I was a senior in November. And I remember it was minus 15. And I was like, cool. I don't think I've ever seen a negative number before.
That's cool. And not Celsius, 15 Fahrenheit.
Yes. Yeah. Or maybe it was just 15. Yeah. I don't see.
Still cold.
Still cold. It was cold. Colder than I've ever experienced. And I had insulated coveralls. I still have those. They're a little tighter than they used to be, but that's okay. I could get them zipped up.
I don't think I can wear stuff from 15 years ago myself. So
okay, good. I just have to wear the jacket on the outside, not the inside. But I have those. I have the other thing that I remembered that I wore in South Dakota that I don't have are these insulated over boots.
Mm-hmm.
And those were amazing. But after you've put on your, like, oh gosh, I had long underwear, jeans, just like a long shirt and then a flannel shirt. A sweater and a jacket and a beanie and a wild rag and the insulated coveralls, and then you go to put on those over boots and you're sweating.
I have visions of the little kid from Christmas Story. You can't put his arms down.
I will be prepared for Antarctica.
Or deep sea diving, one of the two.
Yeah, the great thing is that they're layers, so if I am too hot, I can just take some of them off.
That's true. So,
my main fear is I won't be able to bend over.
That's why there's students there, they can do that.
Yeah, I'll just point.
Yeah, exactly. Take care of that.
Yes. Yeah. Climb over the fence. Where's the gate?
John Helley from up just north of there, from Duckworth, says there's no bad weather, just bad clothing choices. And I think you've made good clothing choices. That sounds good.
Good. We'll see. I only have 2 wool shirts. So it's like, you know, I'm prepared for cold weather, but I'm prepared for like one day at a time.
Yeah. That's the benefit of wool. You can wear it multiple days.
Yes, and I plan to. And they did say there's a laundry machine set up there, so all the non-wool items I can wash.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Laura told me last night, so Laura worked lambing up there in 2021, and she said that wool socks and muck boots were all she needed to keep her feet warm. But okay. As long as she was moving around, that was sufficient. So you should be okay.
Okay. I got that.
Unless it's really, really cold.
I know.
How cold has it been up there? Have you looked?
No. I probably should.
Don't want to know.
I know. I'm living in my ignorance is bliss. I have one of my colleagues is up there right now, one of my friends, And she has sent pictures, and the apartment where she is, she sent a picture of the back door. It's like snow. I mean, you can't even see outside. There's snow from the ground to the ceiling.
Awesome. But
yeah. Right now in Du Bois, Idaho, it is 31 degrees.
Oh,
that's not
lovely.
Bad. I've done that many
times. Sleep weather.
Yeah.
It's colder than that in San Francisco in the summertime.
Seriously. I used to wear sweaters and shorts. It'd be fine. Yeah.
That's going to be a great, great trip. That'll be really, really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm really interested to see how they manage it with different, like how many staff they have in the barn and how they do a lot of that. Because as you know, I would love to get our numbers back up at the Hopland Research and Extension Center. And it'd be really nice to know kind of what sort of management styles could work and, you know, with our modern labor expenses and all of that.
You know, I've talked a little bit with Laura and her experience working there and then working at a different ARS facility. And Dr. Haley Wilmer, who's the range researcher there at Du Bois, and I've talked some about some of this kind of thing. And I think maybe it's the nature of sheep versus cows, but it sounds like it's kind of all hands on deck at lambing time there, as opposed to, oh, well, you're the range person. You don't help with calving. That's the cowboy's job. And I think that's maybe a little bit different in terms of the species and at least our relationship to the species, right?
Yeah.
And sheep and cattle.
Yeah. Yeah. They're a lot more approachable.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And nobody goes to town to buy a sheep boy hat.
Yeah.
It goes with being a cowboy.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
So what will you be doing while you're there?
I will get to work with four vet students.
Are they all Davis students?
No, I think only two of them are from Davis.
Okay.
I can't remember. I think there's one coming from Penn, one coming from Iowa, maybe. But cool. there's students coming from all over, which is so cool that they're getting this experience. Yeah. I did not do this as a vet student.
Yeah.
And I went to the Meat Animal Research Center in Nebraska, where they used to have a herd of cows that reliably had twins.
Oh, yeah.
And they were the funkiest looking cows ever. But so it was kind of similar, but it was all like pulling calves and finding calves or heifers usually that needed to come in for pulling. They pulled every single animal. I think it was a research project to see if you could get multiples from cows and if it was an economic benefit. And I think because of the labor demand, it did not pan out.
Yeah, it's not quite like pulling a lamb.
No. Oh my gosh. We had one heifer come in and we were joking. We're like, there's no way she has twins. She's so small. And she got in there and, you know, of course you always check after you pull a calf or a lamb. And so we pulled the first one, went back in. The second one was right there. Pulled that one and we're like, ho, we'll check and see. And there was a third calf in there. We're like, oh my God, where did she put these? Like, so. Yeah, it was wild. I don't know how they eat. Like, we don't usually see pregnancy toxemia in cows, but I mean, if anyone was going to have it, it would have been her, but she did great. Yeah.
We had a ewe that had, like, when we were first supposed to start lambing, so like the 21st of February, I think, she was in labor while I was out there, and somebody's going to criticize me for coughing now.
Yep.
But I did my normal routine of walking all over, giving her time. She hadn't progressed. Caught her and reached in, and there was a leg and a nose. And I reached in up over the top of the nose, and another lamb bit me.
Huh.
And so they were all trying to come out apparently at the same time. Pulled the first one out, and the second one then just like popped out right away. And I thought, nah, they're big lambs. There's no way she's got three. And I reached back in and lamb number three also bit me.
Wow. And
so one of them, the first lamb, I think
probably had been stuck longer than I realized, didn't end up making it. But man, the two in the back of the line are just doing great. They're growing, but it's always funny to reach in and have something bite on you that you don't expect to.
Yeah. You're like, okay, well, they're alive.
Yeah, that's good sign. Yeah.
Has everyone lambed? Your friendly you, has she lambed yet?
She has not. We thought she was open, but she stands there and lets us do all sorts of things before she has lambed.
Yeah.
So Laura checked, she doesn't even really have a bag, but Laura checked her last night. She has milk in both quarters. So either she's really weird or she could still be like 3.5 weeks away from lambing. So
yeah,
I assume that if she has milk, there probably is a bun in the oven, but
yeah,
we'll see.
That's funny.
So but everybody else is lambed out, and I've talked to Ryan Hendart, and he said they're doing good down there.
Good.
Interesting to see what they look like when they come back.
Yeah.
But
what does he think about having British breeds of sheep?
He was all worried about having to paint brand them when they got there so he wouldn't mix them up. And I said, oh, right. There, you won't have any question about which ones are mine.
They probably won't even commingle with his sheep. Like, what are those?
No, they're, I'm sure they're smaller than his big old Western whiteface ewes.
Yeah. By a long shot.
<That's> mine.
That's cool.
I hope maybe I can go down and see him in a couple of weeks and cool. See how they're doing. He's on there grazing in a solar project. He does a lot of solar grazing. So they're one of his projects. So
that's perfect for them.
Yeah. It'd be good.
Their resume is growing.
Right. That's right. I'm gonna make CVs for each of the ewes. That's good. Yeah.
The ecosystem services they have provided.
That's right. Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's gonna be a great trip. I'm really excited to hear what your observations are and kind of what the sheep are like. And
yeah.
What breeds do they have? Do you know? I know Brett told us when he was on earlier.
Yeah, I think they have polypays, ?
They do too.
And I remember at one point they had targies. I'm not sure if they still have a lot of targies.
I think they still have targies. And I think they took some hair sheep from the mark.
Okay.
To evaluate hair sheep versus wool sheep.
Okay. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I think we've gotten all of the safety warnings and to remind us that they're range sheep and they're coming into this facility once a year. And, you know, they probably come in for shearing and all that, but like just to,
they're not pets.
Be careful and don't take your eyes off of them. And, and they have brand new lambs and we know how they have to play.
Yeah. And some of them can count and some of them can't.
Yeah. So I'm really excited about that part, like showing the students what we look for before they've lambed, really. I'm curious to see what size groups they have the ewes in, because I think that kind of impacts how closely you can watch groups, but we'll see.
It'll be interesting to see what they do after they're jailed. Do they go into mixing pens before they
do? Yeah, I asked all these questions. I was like, I kind of need to know what they're going into. Yeah. But so they go into the jugs, and I believe they're only there for a day, which is pretty typical. And then it depends on how well they're doing and all of that. And then so we go through all the jugs in the morning, make sure they all look good. And then they go into mixing pens, and then they have, if there are some that need more attention, then there's like a separate pen where they can go into where they don't go out.
Okay.
But I think they have been going out into pastures at this point, and it's been pretty cold. So from what I've heard, they're getting to defrost some lambs and have some exciting experiences with how well they do. And I think it's so good for students to see that. And it's a good reminder for us, like, just because something looks really dismal, like don't like still give it a chance, you know?
Yeah.
It sounds like in my friend who's up there right now, these lambs are frozen like a brick. I mean, they cannot move. And they get them defrosted and get some warm colostrum in them, and they're nursing within a couple hours. And
amazing.
Yeah, they're so amazing. And I remember when I was in the hospital, we'd have little kids come in with, like, goat kids come in with, they if they had diarrhea, they sometimes their blood pH goes down to like 5.8. Normal is 7.4.
Wow.
And usually if it gets much below 6.5, you're like, this is not compatible with life. Like what?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you get them corrected with bicarb and some fluids, and they're up and alive and they look somewhat normal. And you know, with diarrhea, you have to keep them going for a little bit longer, but usually if you can get them nursing again within a day, like they're good to go.
And
it's so cool to see that when you see something that just looks like it's not compatible with life and you give it a chance.
It's just bad. And I think that's the other part that the students are going to get from working with you too, is that this is a production setting. You know, that's do what you can, but it's got to make economic sense and
absolutely
labor sense and all of that too, which is hugely important.
That was one of my favorite things with calves. We don't see a lot of cat, like commercial calves in the hospital anymore, I don't think, but we used to. And it was really neat because you could correct, if you could just correct their pH and do oral fluids and, you know, get them rehydrated, correct their pH and get them back nursing within 24 hours, you could send them home and they'd be okay.
Yeah.
And it was that, because you need to be able to do this with as little investment as possible so that it makes financial sense.
Yep.
And those are things that even like our herd health service would teach our herd health clients how to do that. Like, this is how you recognize these. There's even studies to show like this, based on their head and ears, how droopy, how much bicarb you'd probably need to correct.
Yeah,
and so just with visual cues, you could tell what kind of corrections you'd need to make. And it's something that should, you know, we could teach people how to do on farm. And, you know.
Yeah. Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. I'm excited. I get to be a real vet again.
Oh, that'll be fun. That'll be awesome. I was, as you were talking about frozen lambs, one of the best things about this lambing season, it's just been here in Northern California, it's been really wet since what, like the third week of February is when it started again.
Yeah.
And we were right below the snow line in Auburn, had a couple of times when we had snow that stuck for a couple hours, but that's rough lambing weather to have wet snow and wind and all of that. And the lambs would be huddled up with mom and doing fine, but boy, give them an afternoon of sunshine, even if the temp didn't warm up, they were out bouncing and running around. And just, it's so cool to see animals that are out on pasture like that. Just they're adapted to those conditions.
They're made for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I know. I was talking to Allison because they had a lot of snow.
Yeah.
I think it stuck for like a week, which is really unusual.
Crazy.
And they lost a few lambs, like not many. And it's just like, what?
Yeah.
They even had, I mean, just because of the winds and everything, they had fences break with like trees that fell. And I mean, it just sounds like they were able to recover from all of that. And everyone looks, I got to see all the lambs because they were vaccinating yesterday as we were getting the ewes through, and they look so good.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah.
I guess that's the point to end on. I think we talked about this with the lambing school that we did. And we've talked about what you're prepared to be dressed for.
Yeah.
But you know, part of raising livestock outside means you got to be outside, right?
Yep.
That it's even though we make fun of our cattlemen or cattle producer friends, they got to be outside in all kinds of weather too.
Yep.
That's kind of what you sign up for if you decide to raise these kinds of animals, isn't it?
How do they wear beanies under their cowboy hat?
Oh, two words for you. You might want to invest in one before you go.
Okay.
Stormy Cromer.
Stormy Cromer. Are those the wool hats with the flaps?
The flaps that just slide down. They don't untie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, check. You might be able to find a Stormy Cromer in Idaho Falls, even.
Okay. They're awesome. You'd be like, we have to make a really quick stop.
Yes, exactly.
Someone's picking me up because I decided I didn't want to get a rental car. I'm like, can we please have a local who knows how to drive in these elements pick me up so I don't do something wrong?
So they'll know about Stormy Cromers. You could say, hey, we've got to stop and get a Stormy Cromer on the way out.
Okay. Do you think they'll have it at Walmart? Because I have to pick up my groceries at Walmart. Probably not. Yeah. But maybe yeah. There's a store near the Walmart that we could stop
it
in.
It could be like a Western Wear feed supply. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're good hats.
I think that's reasonable.
Yeah. I think that's a reasonable plan.
Sorry, I interjected.
No, I think, see, that's all part of what this podcast is about. Fashion recommendations. So what was your question again?
I don't remember.
No, but we have to be outside, right? That's part of the deal. So if you don't like being outside, maybe you shouldn't raise rangeland livestock.
Yeah.
Not the career choice you want to make.
Yeah.
Or be a vet, a large animal vet.
You still have to be outside, excuse me.
No, that's what I mean.
Oh, you're saying, or like, don't be a large animal vet.
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. I took that wrong. I was like, wait a minute.
I wasn't clear.
Yes. I'll never forget when I was in South Dakota as a student with my mentor, Dr. Hoffman. We were fighting over who got to preg check the cows because it was quite warm in there. Like, okay, my turn.
Roger reminded me, this has probably been 7 or 8 years ago. We had like triplets that died before they were delivered and they were all tangled up and we couldn't get them out. And so I called Sammy and she came, a horrible two-track road, came out in her vet car and Roger goes, wow, this is just like James Harriet, isn't it? So that reminded me, we still need to do our...
We do
our
need review. To do that with the little car.
maybe Dr. Bravos needs to get a Model A for his practice. I think now that he's been to Yorkshire, I think he needs the car.
Oh, that's he has lived the Harriet experience. Oh. We need to do this. And it has been my job to try to coordinate all of your schedules. And I have failed.
Well, yeah, because we're so easy to track down.
I know, you won't get back to me. It'll happen.
Coming soon. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Well, Dan, thank you so much. I really appreciate you sharing. This has been a really wonderful conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for making time before your big trip, and have a great time in Dubois. Can't wait to hear all about it. And this has been Sheep Stuff You Should Know. I'm Dan Makin up here in Auburn, where the sun is actually shining today. First sunshine we've seen in a couple of weeks. Dr. Rosie Bush down at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, soon to be at the U.S. Sheep Experiment Station.
Yeah.
Have a great trip.
Thanks, Dan. Talk to you soon.
Talk to you later.